Good afternoon, everyone. It is 1:35, and I'm going to call this meeting to order. We're going to begin with a roll call. Beth Golden, Chairwoman of the Sex Center Management Board.
Brecken Blades, Vice Chairwoman of the Sex Center Management Board.
Farah Loki, DDD Quality Manager.
Jeff McClure, Pinal County Board of Supervisors.
Peter Morey, Board Member.
Shane Neal, Board Member.
Melanie Opine, Treatment Provider.
Nicholas Pulaski with DCS, Board Member.
Anna Young, Superior Court Judge, Yavapai County.
Ben Cook, Pinal County Sheriff's Office, Board Member.
Amanda Adkins, Arizona Department of Corrections.
Jamie Baldwin, Founding Attorney and Executive Director of Legal Services for Crime Victims in Arizona.
Blake Barney, Treatment Provider.
Colette Chapman, Arizona Department of Education, Board Member.
Ben Delano, Polygraph Examiner.
Stevie Gray, PCS.
Jim Hanratty, Polygraph Examiner.
Katie Kretschy, Public Defender, Board Member.
Victoria Baldner, Counsel for the Board.
Jenna Mitchell, Arizona Department of Public Safety.
Anthony Davis, ACDPS.
And welcome, Ben Villarno.
Thank you.
Go ahead. I'm so sorry. Go ahead.
ACDPS.
Here's use ACDPS.
Thank you, everyone. And again, welcome, Ben Villarno, who is our second polygraph examiner. Welcome to the board. Thank you for being here. We're no longer doing the minutes because they were posted online. So just so everyone is aware, they are on our website posted. So we're going to move into call to the public. I'm going to turn over to Jenna at this time.
Ronald Brown.
Thank you guys for allowing me to speak here today. First off, my name is Ronald Brown, and I just wanted to, first of all, if anyone here has ever been a victim of sexual abuse or anything of that nature, I just want to first say sorry for whatever you went through, and there is hope. I am a probationer. I'm on lifetime probation, and I'll start off with a little bit of my story. When I was 19 years old, I was a drug addict. I was just an immature, rebellious teenager, and I just did not care about the rules. And when I was 19, I had sex with a 14-year-old girl, and when I was 27, I was a full-blown meth addict, and I was working at an apartment complex and had some sexual relations with a few women there, and I got accused of sexual assault. I was arrested in 2018 when I was 30 years old, and the DNA evidence from the 2016 crime was linked me back to the 14-year-old girl in 2008. I don't condone in my selfish actions. Prison was the best thing that ever happened to me. I completely turned my life around and in my 15-year drug addiction. I came to faith in Jesus Christ. I became truthful, honest. My family saw the difference, the change in me. I started working out and just wanting to try sobriety and stay on the straight and narrow. I became determined. As of right now, when I was in prison, I completed the sex offender treatment program they had in there. Now on probation, I'm on lifetime probation. I'm almost done with my second round through treatment. I have no violations, nothing like that on probation. But right now I'm here to talk about the contradictions of lifetime probation. Because as of right now, there's a girl that I have that I love, and I can't even be with her because she's a felon on probation. So probation is supposed to be a fixed period of time to where you can prove yourself worthy. And I was lied to during my plea agreement. They said I could get off in 2 years with good behavior, and now they're saying it's going to be a lot longer than that.
Sir, just a reminder, you have 30 seconds.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, for the amount of probationers that they have, we only see our probation officers for 5 or 10 minutes a month. That's how busy they are. And because of how busy they are, like what happened a couple weeks ago with that guy that just walked in the school, it's like, you know, they're wasting time with people like me who are determined, who are doing good for society, who have turned their life around. And now we can't even watch the real people who have no business trying to be rehabilitated or do good at all. And it's really sad. And the reason I'm here today is because when I saw that story on the news, I'm tired of being put in the same category as somebody like that who obviously had warning signs that people ignored or didn't see or were too busy to notice. And I had to come down here and say something because my whole family is just like, they're scared.
Sir, I'm going to ask you to wrap it up if you don't mind. I appreciate your comments.
Okay.
If you could finish up.
Well, the last thing I want to say is just that to every victim in here, I do have empathy for your pain. My stepmother and my mother are victims of sexual assault, and they're happy to see the transformation that I have made in my life. And with God, can bring good out of any situation, and I'm proof of that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Vicki, Papa.
Just a quick reminder, public, three minutes per person. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the board. My name is Vicki Campo, and I serve as the communications director for Arizona's for Rational Sex Offense Laws. I'm here today to respectfully urge this board to invite Professor Ira Ellman, retired from Arizona State University, to present his research on the American Law Institute's model penal code revisions and evidence-based mechanisms for registry removal. Professor Ellman's research will facilitate this board's goal of governing with evidence rather than fear by incorporating findings from scientific research into the decision-making process. I come before you today with a unique perspective. My stepdaughter is a rape survivor, and my heart breaks for her every day. I also have a son who's on the Arizona Registry. He was a college student who had an encounter with someone in high school. And while I cannot claim the relationship was legal, she was underage, what I can tell you is that this was not a violent, predatory act. As communications director, I hear heartbreaking stories every week, like we just heard, from victims whose pain is unimaginable and from families torn apart by laws that fail everyone. I want to be clear, I never want to see new victims, but I must tell you that our current approach achieves neither justice for victims nor public safety for our communities. The foundation of our current system is built on the falsehood that recidivism for those who commit sexual offenses is, quote, frightening and high. This claim has no factual basis, yet has infected our entire legal framework and has been cited in over 90 judicial opinions nationwide. AZRSOL would like to offer our assistance in facilitating a presentation by Professor Ellman and putting together an agenda that brings current research directly to this board. The goal we all share is preventing sexual violence. To achieve that, we must have the courage to acknowledge when our current approach fails and pursue policies that actually work. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Matthew Ellis.
All right. Thank you for having me, guys. I'm Matthew Ellis. I'm here because I have been a registered sex offender since 2013. So the choices and the point of views the board comes to over time will affect my life forever. I'm on lifetime registration. So the choices you guys make here are going to affect my life for the rest of my life. I have successfully completed all my dues. I did all my jail time, all my fines and fees. I've completed therapy. I've done everything the state has asked of me. I've successfully completed probation. All the while maintaining employment, even with the hurdles that these troubles bring. So it's taken a lot to get up here today and speak to you guys. It's very difficult and very stressful for me to come and speak here with you guys. So a minute in here. I'm not going to go through my case, but I wanted to touch on how it's affected my life. So I did 7 years of probation. That consisted of 12 polygraphs in 7 years, passed every single one. I was checked on every single Halloween and my birthday. I also had to register with the state every year on my birthday. that comes out to 84 surveillance checks over 7 years and 84 check-ins, plus all the therapy. I was sat down with other sex offenders that were more violent than me, got out of probation, got 3 motions to terminate later, got out, did my time. Great, you're doing great, kid. Go out there, do your thing. Since then, I've had trouble finding employment, trouble finding housing, cannot get an apartment. I self-submitted to an EDMR program for minor PTSD. My trauma comes not from my initial incident, but from this system. Getting flyer, getting arrested at work, notifying all my friends in my neighborhood of my crime. Even though I've done everything you've asked of me, you guys do not tell my neighborhoods, my neighbors, that I've completed therapy, that I passed all my polls, that I want healthy relationships. You send out a flyer, and my neighbors don't have the tools, they're not involved in this world, to understand my charges. So, you know, I continually wake up every day, try to be a good person. I want kids. This has complicated my life and my parents' life and my sister's life. It destroyed our family, okay? And you guys are trying to control. I have 10 seconds left. I'm not going to get there. I wanted to just introduce myself. I also want to say, I'm going to end with this. We have a lot in common. I want a safer community. I want healthy relationships. You guys are trying to police and monitor sexuality, and it's diverse. And I applaud you for that. But I was working at Special Olympics when my crime came down. I didn't choose that job to try and abuse
Thank
kids.
You.
You guys need to build a system that's can Thank discern you. Enough to discern predators from
thank
individual
you for,
issues.
Thank you for coming
for
out today. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm going to ask Victoria to give us an update on our bylaws.
Working on the bylaws, they're almost done. In discussion with Madam Chair, her suggestion was that Major Mitchell email all of you with the second draft, and if you would please respond in writing with questions, comments, etc. I think the idea was to save time during the meeting rather than spend an hour and a half going back and forth about stuff, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So expect an email. We ask that to the extent you have time to look at the second draft that you do so and provide your questions, comments on them.
Thank you. Moving on to item B, discussion of the mission statement and guiding principles. We had the same discussion regarding those items. We're going to discuss those with any additional emails you all have. If you could get them into DPS staff prior to the next meeting so they're all in writing for the board to then consider and then discuss and plan to vote on both of these items next month with hopefully a more limited discussion. We need to have a longer one, we can, but I'm hoping to save us some time. So if anybody has any additional items or changes for either of those things, if you could get them in ahead of time and we can discuss them next month. The next item on the agenda is the board duties and responsibilities. I believe you all received a copy of that. Do we need to go into executive session to discuss? I'm not hearing a motion to go into exec to discuss these items, so we're going to move on to D, the virtual meeting updates and future meeting dates, which I'm going to turn over to Lieutenant Colonel Mitchell.
DPS is continuing to pursue a virtual hybrid meeting option for the board. We have made progress since our last meeting. We have identified Teams Premium as being the platform that will meet our needs to have a town hall type meeting that allows for board members and public participation. We have initiated a requisition to purchase the additional licenses. We hope to pilot and have some testing of that before we roll it out live for all of you. We're looking at the early spring of next year to be able to roll that out for you. Yes, and I think it might be helpful to use it for the subcommittees, kind of pilot and test it in the subcommittees before we bring the larger group together, just to get a better understanding of, participation. We want to make sure that it doesn't hinder your ability to participate actively in the meetings when we hold them.
And I will add, I will be most likely in person every chance I get, and I still encourage all of us to meet in person as much as we possibly can as we're beginning this board and getting it off the ground. I think it's really important, so I do want to emphasize that. I do understand the virtual option can be important, but I also think meeting in person as much as we can is also important as well. We're going to move on. Oh, yes. Did everyone also receive a copy of the board meeting dates? Okay, everyone received those in your packet, and I believe they will also be posted online. Okay. And to clarify what I said at the beginning, the minutes is actually the recording from last month, so the recording is posted on the website, to clarify that. I asked Dr. Gray and Dr. Blades to give us a presentation today on introduction to sex offender treatment models. And I am entertaining, if any of you want to see, also a future presentation on things, as we all have our different specialties or areas of expertise, if you would like to discuss that as we call for agenda items or whatnot, or you'd like to speak to us about presentations, I think it's important that we educate ourselves and have these discussions. So I asked Dr. Gray, thank you, and Dr. Blades to talk to us today about different sex offender treatment models. So I'm going to turn this over to them. Thank you.
Could I be able to go sit next to Dr. Gray and ask Mr. Henry to just slide over? Hello. I'm Dr. Brecken Blades. I'm a psychologist specializing in the assessment and treatment of sexual misbehavior. I work at Psychological and Consulting Services, which was founded by Dr. Gray. So I'm saying to you.
And I'm Steve Gray, and I've been around for 100 years. And I'm going to encourage Dr. Blades to be the boss here, because I used to be her boss. Now she's my boss, and I turned that up as loud as it would go. Okay. So what I'm going to do is let her take the lead, and then what I'll do is kibitz behind her the whole time. And I don't really know whether or not we wanted to ask questions, because if we ask questions, we'll be here till tomorrow. And if we just run through it, we'll be here in about 10 minutes. No, I'm just kidding. And y'all can read, too, because up there and everywhere. So, go.
Okay. I put a slide for questions at the end, so there will be time for that. Okay. Do I have the thing, or you can go to the next? Okay. All right. So, with the understanding that most individuals who've committed sex offenses will be released back to the community at some point, it's important that we have a plan for assessing risk, treating, and supervising these individuals. As well, once they're in the community, we want to know on an ongoing basis if their risk to the community has decreased as a result of all of our efforts and the resources they've received, or, though of course we hope not, if risk is increasing. So, what we're going to talk about today is kind of a foundation of the models of treatment and supervision that are being used. The risk-need responsivity model, or the R&R model, really guides sex offender assessment, rehabilitation, treatment by matching the level of intervention, services, and resources to the individual's risk of reoffending. So we're going to talk about how to target criminogenic needs and then adjust treatment and supervision to the individual's abilities and characteristics. Research, generally shows us that programs that adhere to these three core principles, risk, need, responsivity, have been found to be most effective in reducing reoffending, not only in sort of sex offender treatment and supervision programs, but also just across general kind of correctional populations as well.
You're doing great.
Okay, so the first of those three core principles is the risk principle. So sort of just like it sounds, this involves assessing an individual's risk to reoffend and then ultimately focusing services on those who are assessed to be moderate risk or higher. So the application of the risk principle would involve assigning the major share of the available resources to the highest risk individuals, moderate levels of resources to individuals representing moderate risk, and then relatively few resources to people who are assessed to be a low risk. Intuitively or sort of logically, the risk principle makes sense with the idea that we put more effort into people that we're most concerned about and then less effort into those that we're not as concerned about. When low risk and high risk sex offenders are treated and supervised sort of identically or exactly the same, the system can end up being really inefficient and expensive. So we want to avoid that.
Well, okay, we're talking about research activities, and some of the people that were presenting here talked about it. And The thing of it is that there has been a lot of research that done on risk assessment for sex offenders. And I don't know what to say about that, except that when it first started, there wasn't any kind of correlates attached to it in the sense of numbers and people. But now there is. And the one test that we use the most is the static 99R. And the thing that's problematic for me right now is we have some people in here that know a lot about this and some people that probably don't even know that this stuff exists. But this device has been in place for about 30 years. And if you look at the, well, you can see that up there. And it's real simple to talk about it in terms of age of release and ever lived with someone and prior. And then that's great. And then when you start looking at, I just looked at the manual before I came here this morning, and it's like 35 pages long and has a number of really sticky, tricky things in it. And so sometimes there's some reliability issues, so I have to address that at another time. But then there's another one, the static 90, static 2000R. I'm not familiar with that too much. But
okay, well, really, there are two types of risk assessments. There are static risk assessments, which Dr. Gray was just talking about, and then there's also dynamic risk assessments, okay? So when we're talking about the R&R model, the risk principle primarily involves assessing static risk factors, which are, as Dr. Gray kind of listed and you have up there, on the whole, really not changeable. You know, criteria that they do relate to risk for sexual recidivism, but once these factors are present, they remain an indicator of risk. So, for example, if someone has a history of additional sexual offenses, these are life events that can't be changed, right? They're historical, it happened, it's done. These static risk factors are empirically supported. The static 99R and 2002R use an actuarial or sort of a mathematical process. The factors remain constant, although it is generally understood, and this is important, that the longer an individual is in the community free of detected sexual offending behaviors, then the lower their risk of sexual recidivism becomes. Okay, but for the risk portion of this, we're going to look at static risk factors. Okay. We also kind of more broadly want to look at sort of just conceptualizing risk for sexual reoffense in general. The risk assessment, as we're talking about in this model, has an impact on the level and the intensity of probation supervision and the treatment services that someone receives. You know, it's also important to take into consideration mental health issues, such as maybe someone has psychosis, cognitive disorders, developmental issues, personality disorders. The concept maybe of psychopathy should be considered as being relevant to someone's risk and their needs, as the R&R model kind of exists on a continuum as we decide where to apply resources. Okay, so next is the need principle. So the need principle assesses kind of the issue of what to treat. So if you think of the risk principle as who to treat, now we moved on to the what to treat. So treatment and supervision should focus on addressing criminogenic needs, which are the dynamic risk factors directly associated with reoffense. Okay, so we're going to work on targeting the things that would make someone even more risky. Okay, so I'm going to explain a little bit about dynamic risk assessment. So in applying the need principle that's addressing what to treat, an individual's criminogenic needs or their dynamic risk factors need to be assessed. You can think of these as potentially changeable risk factors that are linked to sexual offending. So whereas the static risk factors are largely historical and won't change, dynamic risk factors are changeable and are often identified as treatment targets. Assessment of dynamic risk developed out of a need to more thoroughly measure change and to be able to track whether the treatment and supervision resources that are being applied are making a difference, right? Because if you're only assessing static factors, then you're not going to be able to see the change. So dynamic factors give us an ability to track that. They're measured at regular intervals, and
like I said, they're changeable, but that would be in either direction. Okay, so if someone ideally changes in a positive direction, but also it would capture kind of the picture if someone is struggling and maybe putting themselves or becoming a higher risk. Like I said, they're often identified as treatment targets. So right now in Maricopa County, the dynamic risk assessment that's being used is the first one on the slide, the SOTIPS, or the Sex Offender Treatment Intervention and Progress Scale. So there are other options, but that's the one that Maricopa County Adult Probation is utilizing, and then their treatment agencies are also using it.
And just a point, the person that was talking about that he had done all the work, he'd gone to counseling, gone to therapy, did this, was on supervision and still on some sort of supervision. This kind of material can be used to help develop a research-based model of how to determine how much supervision a person needs. And that means that some of them may not need any supervision at all. But there's no real way to do it except with this kind of material. And I will tell you that there's been a lot of research done on it, and also in different places too, not just Arizona. Most of the states now have models that look at risk and then treatment and then what kind of supervision they have and then what kind of supervision they'll need. And some people may not need supervision for the rest of their lives. But this is a way to do it where it's more than just like feel good kind of stuff. So I hope people appreciate the amount of research that's gone into some of this stuff.
Sorry, Peter Morey, member. Is it okay if I ask a question? Just for my own edification, when we're talking about the criminogenic needs and type of supervision someone will need, just a thought that popped in my head, and I apologize if this is the wrong place for that, but this could also be something that we're looking at as far as treatment. Like, we had one individual up there, and I think something that we're concerned about with this board in general is having low-risk offenders getting too much treatment, over-treating them and exposing them to possible more criminogenic factors that are going to increase their recidivism rates. So is there some sort of test or something built into these models that would help us assess when a person is being over-treated? That's kind of just a general question. I don't know.
We do. When people come in on probation, say, and they come in for their intake and they get put into treatment for the, you know, court's orders, they are matched in terms of we estimate kind of their risk level and we put them in groups, which is how treatment is done, is in groups according to risk level. And you're absolutely correct. We wouldn't put a low risk person with a really high risk person.
Right.
With lots of
risk. But do we have, and I'm just thinking as we're kind of gearing up here, do we have a way to track them through the treatment so that they don't end up being in higher acuity treatment when they don't need it as they're moving through?
Well, they end up in maintenance program. I don't know if they're still doing that. I haven't been involved with probation that much lately. But so they would be gradually moved from, say, once a week to once a month to even quarterly. And the idea of discharge from treatment, I'm not up on that right now, so I couldn't help you there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, so on the next slide, there are some examples of what you could call criminogenic needs or what are determined to be dynamic risk factors. And so these are the items that are targeted for, you know, change or improvement in treatment, and then also, you know, in supervision, of course, and then assessed sort of along the way and at regular intervals. We do, at least in terms of probation, require regular updates on progress, and it includes sort of an assessment and a scoring to some degree of these different items. Like I said, as they're reported on the SOTIFs, as the case is in Maricopa County. So you can see that some of these are things that are, you can certainly work on someone's ability to solve problems. You can help them have a more pro-social support system. Some of those things are treatment targets, we would call them, more or targeted to change. Some of these also are going to overlap with different maybe criteria for mental health issues. And so that gets kind of woven into there as well as you're working with people. Do you want to say anything about this? Okay. These are just a sample of that. Okay. The final principle is the responsivity principle. So this is talking about the how to treat. So we did the who to treat, what to treat, and now we're talking about how to treat. And so really this refers to using cognitive behavioral and social learning type approaches to help people change while taking each person's sort of learning style and their, like I said before, their different characteristics and needs into consideration when providing the services or matching them with resources in terms of maybe their level of supervision, or I think Mr. Moore, as you're kind of referring to in terms of exactly what it is they need in treatment, we have specialized groups that are based on risk. We also have groups especially for individuals who've been diagnosed with a serious mental illness and different than sort of configurations of groups to try to match people to what they need to get the most out of it. Okay. So the last part of responsivity is just kind of a general outline of how services are delivered, ideally or sort of roughly. So like I said, you'd use kind of a cognitive behavioral or CBT, which would be cognitive behavioral therapy. We might hear people say CBT, which is kind of the gold standard across the board in therapy at this point in time, working with the individual's characteristics, skills, you know, why is this skill useful, modeling, practicing, developing a feedback model, helping the person really implement and then integrate whatever skills are being offered. So, okay, that is a very, very basic overview of how sort of treatment, where it's built on. Okay, so ideally we're using this R&R model and going up from there. We're happy to answer questions.
Yes, Barlow, DDD. So as we look at these risk assessments, are these risk, do they have questions for the built in for those in the IDD population or the, you know, disabled intellectual disabilities population, or are you using kind of lateral assessments to assess their abilities along with these static assessments, and along with that, with the responsivity, the therapies, are you just tailoring by gestalt, or are there assessments to tailor the therapy for those who are part of that?
It's not necessarily built in, say, to the static 99R questions. I believe it is addressed in the manual in terms of who is appropriate to use with the population. So they took it into account in their development of the instrument. In terms of then what we would do when someone comes into treatment is, as a treatment agency, PCS is an agency contracted with Maricopa County Probation Department, we would rely to some extent on the probation department to send us collateral documents if they have them, to let us know if they've if they have any background information on somebody. Independently, we do give some cognitive screening type instruments, and we have the ability to give more psychological testing if that's needed, or to refer them and say, hey, you know, we've identified what we think is this issue and you would really benefit from a specialized, you know, evaluation here. So we do that. And then, like I said, we do have specialized groups, and we use different workbooks with the individuals in group in order to sort of meet them cognitively where they are, and the groups are paced differently. So yeah, we do try to take consideration.
Does that answer your question?
For the most part.
Okay.
For the most part.
Okay.
That's where the question's longer than the answer.
And Madam Chair, I've got a question. Anna Young, I'm the Yavapai County Superior Court. I work only with juveniles, and so I know that a lot of what you said crosses over into the treatment of juveniles who sexually offend, but the testing is different, correct?
I think for the most part it is. I mean, what I know, some of the cognitive screening and things like that can be given to juveniles. We treat youthful, which is still starting at age 18, so it's on the adult contract. So we don't treat juveniles in a group setting for treatment at our office, the individual thing. Some of the instruments that we use have adolescent versions to them, but I couldn't say with certainty that those specifically are what's being used at juvenile agencies.
I went back and I looked at some of the psychosexuals that I've received recently and kind of made a list of the different, you know, testing modalities that the providers are giving me, and
I've never seen static on one-on-ones I see. I see things like the JSOAP and, you know, they do like the MACI and things like that. But
no, you're right. And the static is only appropriate for adults. You're right. So you wouldn't see that. I was thinking of, but yes, yes. Thank you.
Although they do say it's okay to use the static on a 17-year-old, and that's just not below that, though.
Yeah, there are some exceptions, but generally, assessing risk with juveniles is more difficult.
I'm looking through this pile of paper stuff. I have statistics on relapse for Arizona, and I published an article with Dr. Abel. And we included the relapse rates for different years, 5 years, 10 years, up through 15 years. And the study was done on Arizona, 250 Arizona people and 250 people from one of the Carolinas. I don't remember which, kind of all go together with me. But and I was looking for it. I brought it with me, but I can't find it because I got too many papers to dig through. But other than that, it's a good document to look at in the term of a lot of the recidivism rates you see there on various states and with various criteria for what is recidivism on and on and on like that. And the study that I did has, we are very clear on how we come up with different models. So, and I think I'll actually bring it next time and hand it out. It's kind of tough to read, but that's okay.
Any other questions for us?
Dr. Blaze, could you go back to your static 99, or could we go back to the static screen 99 for a second? And could you clarify, so these are risk assessments, but there are also treatment assessments, which would be a different presentation, that people will come in to then undergo when they begin treatment.
That is correct, yes.
Okay. So I just want to touch on the, with the static 99, and I believe females are also exempt, correct? It's adult males and 17-year-olds, so long as, in my recollection, if the behavior models or mirrors that of an adult offender. If I'm not mistaken, that's what the manual says.
That is correct.
So it would not be a 17 and 15-year-old. It'd have to be like a 17 and I believe like 4-year-old, someone younger, as long as that's my understanding of.
Correct. Yes. Yes. The manual says that the offense would need to be adult-like.
Yes.
In nature.
Okay.
They don't define it further, but yes.
And no females and obviously not juveniles. So if we could go through, because I think examples of factors include, so age, relationships, obviously, you know, prior, I think charges is more clear, and sentencing dates, and then victims who are strangers. Some of this overlaps with the community notification assessment, which is always, you know, widely talked about. Could you, I know I'm putting you on the spot, but briefly go into the why behind some of these. And I also want you, if you don't mind, to touch on historically, when I first started in this field, we used the plethysmograph to, we don't anymore, but could you please touch on the importance of sexual deviancy and the difference between, you know, sexual deviant arousal, deviancy, and could you please touch on the why behind stranger versus family. Do you mind doing that for us?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so on the static 99R, the manual has a pretty high bar for who is strangers. Thank you. strangers, someone who is a stranger is someone who has been known for 24 hours or less, and they really can't be. If you even sort of recognize someone from, you know, the local Circle K or a neighbor, but you're not friends with them, that person is no longer a stranger to. It really truly means stranger victim. There's also criteria on there for unrelated victims, which is obviously a lower bar, someone who's known but not related. Do you want to talk about?
I don't know. The answer, she wants me to tell you why there's a difference. I don't know. I just know there's a difference. And then,
Do you want to tell you what you taught me?
Sadly, I forgot.
What you have taught me about stranger versus acquaintance or family is the impulsivity of the act, for example. Am I right?
No.
I'm not right? Am I wrong?
I led you straight.
Impulsivity a risk factor?
Well, it's
not
necessarily because of her.
You're saying yes.
Well, dynamic risk factor.
Yeah, dynamic?
Okay. Impulsive behavior. Dynamic. Okay.
Impulsive is part of that, yes.
Okay.
And basically it boils down to whether or not you have paraphilic disorders or not, and then what kind of mental health you have as well. And then those two factors get busted down into this kind of stuff, and this is good. You need it when you go to court. So. But
if I could jump in real fast. Oh. So a little background about myself. I'm going to kind of jump in here. Peter Morey, I am a public member, treatment member, but I'm also a psychiatrist as well as an attorney. And so I operate in this field. It also goes to the criminogenic factors and the possibility of psychopathy and antisocial behavior. You're going to be more removed from a person who is a stranger victim and therefore more likely to objectify them, which gives a whole different criteria when you're breaking down between sexual problems versus intimacy problems and approach problems. And so you kind of have different trees that you go down when you begin to decide where is the issue with this individual person. So when we get back to the risk responsivity needs, it kind of gives us a different framework to work with to say, okay, this person has an intimacy deficit or has an approach deficit, they don't know how to flirt, so they just grab somebody. You know, how do we deal with that type of stuff when we're doing sex offender treatment with them? So that's just jumping in there.
No, that's really helpful. I agree with what you're saying, and I do think it floats, floats to sort of the impulsivity factor, and I think, just on a basic level, it's what they've done with each of these factors is sort of empirically related them back to the risk for reoffense. And so people who victimize someone who's a complete stranger, totally unknown to them, it puts them at a higher risk. They're someone who's more likely to do it again, which does then speak to different mental health issues, disorders, and then the criminogenic factors when you think about somebody who might victimize a stranger versus someone known to them. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, you also said... Okay.
Sorry, and also it gets down to sort of the violence in that, like a sexual sadist is going to be more likely to see a person as an object and go after a stranger victim and treat them much differently than someone who, molests their 9-year-old stepdaughter when they're drunk. So there's going to be a whole different dynamic.
True. Amanda Adkins from Arizona Corrections. Sorry. It's also important to remember the Static 99 was built on a bunch of meta-analyses. So each question was pulled, right, because of all these meta-analyses that came together. We were asking about the why.
Melody Opine, I was just going to jump in about the juveniles, and we do a lot of things on risk. We don't have as much psychopathy. We don't have as much paraphilic stuff in nature, but we have. It is not rare, but it is less common for us to have juveniles who have committed offenses towards strangers. It would significantly increase their risk. The majority of them, it is family or friends or neighbors, and it is basically kind of a surrounding and a familiarity.
I have a lot of questions.
Go ahead.
So I work for the sheriff's office.
Oh,
I
state your name, please. I'm sorry.
Ben Cook from Pinal County. And I'm trying to find where we are. First, I have just under 1,000 sex offenders in Pinal County. About 300 of them are on probation. So maybe a third of them are on probation. And so the services that are provided would only be provided probably to that one third of the actual offenders that are registering. And then we're responsible to do the community notification assessment. It's 19 questions. We do it one time, and it sticks with that guy for the rest of his life. I have a guy who's been registering since 1978. Unless the agency wants to, they don't have to. There's no reason to ever redo their assessment. We don't have to. And so most of the things that are in there are static and not going to change. There are, like, if the guy has a job, that can change, and if they've completed counseling, can change. Otherwise, none of it changes. But we did have some questions that I'm not sure. I've heard of the static 99 in 2002, but that's not what we're using. We had questions in regard to the gender of the victim versus offender. If the offender or if the victim is male, they're given points. If the victim is female, there's no points. It doesn't matter what the gender of the offender is. So we don't understand why females aren't, they don't, if the victim is female, there's no points assessed. If the victim is male, there are points assessed. We have no idea why that is. It angers everybody in my unit every time we do an assessment. I thought maybe you guys could explain, or
I think it needs to be revised, frankly, especially it's certain the research shows that people that a male assaulting another male is higher risk than assaulting a female, but that's just a big giant generality that just won't work all the time, because there's more dynamics involved in the whole thing in terms of age discrepancy and how did they track the person down. There's all kinds of things that need to be considered besides you assaulted a male or a female.
I would, Amanda Adkins from Corrections, I would add that the static 99, one of the questions is with if it is a male or female victim, and that the 99 is not normed for females. So it may have been something that was pulled from that assessment that was not meant to be used on females.
Peter Morey, I agree with Dr. Gray. I think this is sort of an anachronistic thing, and also going toward the mental state of the offender. I think that it was historically thought that there would be more violence and more of a power dynamic and brutality with male on male versus male on female. I don't think that's been shown to be the case anymore, but I think it is something that's historically, unfortunately, still around with us.
I spoke to the chair about maybe putting something together from what we're doing and what we're dealing with, and maybe I could bring that assessment just so you guys have an understanding of what we're doing. We're assigning the level that is given to these guys that is published on the website, on the flyers. We're doing the flyers to the community based on these 19 questions. And I believe this test is from the 2001, 2002 is when this assessment was written. I mean, we don't have a method of redoing it. We don't know why the questions are there. We just answer them. There's other questions that deal with the age of the offender. I can have an offender who committed the offense and wasn't convicted for 5 years, but it's the age of conviction that is making the score. And it really didn't make sense. In that 5 years, they went from lots of points to no points because the conviction happened later, whereas when the offense actually occurred in their life. There's just a lot of things that maybe I talked to her and we'll put something together and try to give you guys what it is that we're looking at. But a lot of these things are, I don't know, we don't. The other thing is how often this should be done. I mean, if I'm only the third largest county as far as sex offenders are concerned, I can't imagine having 10,000. If you had to do this assessment more than once per person in their lifetime, how much manpower that's going to take to actually complete assessments. We're actually going through and redoing all our assessments. We haven't even finished the level one, and we've been working for 6 months.
Jim Hanratty, staff examiner, polygraph examiner. I was just wondering, do you guys use SOTIPs at all in Pinal County?
No, not not the sheriff's office. Now, probation is a different thing. They may use
it. Oh, you're a sheriff's office. That's right.
I have no idea what they're doing. That's these other assessments may be done by probation.
You might want to.
Jim Hanratty, you might want to look at the SOTIPS just to see what it looks like for the questions that you have. If you have the ability to change the questionnaire that you guys use, I don't know if you're mandated by a particular.
The assessment is mandated by the state. So the assessment that I use is given to us, and that's what we have to use.
Well, maybe we can change that.
It's on our to-do list, actually. Yeah, thank you. No, it is mandated by statute that they use this. I do have the study that I can send everyone about the female versus male, but it is on our to-do list to update and look at the community notification assessment. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's all I had. I'll let you guys have it back.
I'm jumping in a lot here today. I just wanted to touch on something that you said, Mr. Cook, and actually give props to Ms. Krecky also.
Will you say your name?
Oh, sorry, Peter Morey. With the articles you published and put out to us, I think the only thing that was missing from it, and I will put in the email when we do address that, is the operational viability of the things we come with. So I think that part of what we're hearing, and Mr. Cook brought up, is how do we get this continuum, and what I asked in the questions earlier with Dr. Blades and Dr. Gray, is what we have as follow-up to see the recidivism rate come down, and how do we monitor that so that we're not over-treating and creating victims out of the offenders, in a sense. So.
Jim Hanratty, I have a question regarding recidivism and dynamic risk assessment, and I think Dr. Gray alluded to this because I'm familiar with that study that you talked about with ABLE. Correct me if I'm wrong, that was only based on folks that were on community supervision and in treatment, but all bets were off once they stopped both.
Yes.
So there's that.
I don't have much more to say about that, but we considered to follow people afterwards, but trying to follow people when they're not on supervision is, you know, they just disappear, and they don't like you to show back up either, really, as a rule.
Katie Krecky, I have a couple of questions. So you mentioned, Dr. Blade, that we use the SOTIPS here in Maricopa County. Is there, like, my understanding is, like, the SOTIPS has, like, limited use in terms of predictability. Like, it's only can be used for 18 months when someone's in the community. Is there those same issues with the other dynamic assessments you mentioned?
No. No, you're right. The SOTIPS, part of the limitations of the SOTIPS is that I think their study, yes, it extended out 18 months, or the numerical recidivism estimates are only valid for a 3-year period or so after. So instead of giving a numerical score, what we do as treatment providers is we speak to each item, because they're still supported by research as having, you know, utility in terms of someone's progress and how they're doing, but you're right, you don't give a sort of a numerical score that will correlate to a percentage rate. My understanding is that the stable 2007 does not have the same limitations in terms of their sort of longevity of their predictions.
Yes, and Katie, I'll touch on that, because I was the grant manager when the SOTIPS came here to Maricopa County, and so this study went up to 18 months, and then post 18 months, probation was supposed to use that with treatment as like a guide, not as the research has not gone beyond that. And yeah, it's different with the stable.
Carl, if you have another question, just so I understand, the static, is that just done once, or does that get repeated? Does the dynamic gets repeated that the static does or doesn't?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the static, you really would only do it one time unless someone commits a new sex offense. Sure. So the first item on the static is age at release from the index sex offense. So on this assessment, the index sex offense is the most recent offense that's been committed. So unless someone commits a new offense, it would sort of reset everything, and then that offense would become a prior, if that makes sense. So yeah. Otherwise, you would just do it once. The static really best captures someone's risk to recidivate at the time of their release from that index offense. And you only...
It sounds like there's a gap there because of what he was saying. This feeds into the community notification, correct? The static, or does the dynamic too? Because if that's not being redone necessarily, then you're not changing the community notification. But what if this was done on a regular basis and it would just correlate with new community communications to feed that, fill that gap?
I haven't seen that instrument, so I can't speak to exactly what's on that. We could look at that. Yeah.
There are 19 questions there. Some are the same and some are different.
Uh-huh.
But they're completely different, and that is mandated by statute, and this is something that treatment providers, many of them, will use. Just to chime in. But
well, I have heard that some of this information kind of fed into the community assessment. Or community.
There is overlap with some of the questions. Some of the questions are the same, but two totally different assessments. Both are done at the time of release or pretty much release. Yes, there are a couple dynamic factors on the community notification assessment, such as if an individual completes sex offender treatment. When I managed cases, I used to tell probationers, go ask the detective if they will bring them your successful discharge from sex offender treatment and see if they will bring that down, because some people are on that cusp of level 1, 2, or 2, 3. Some detectives will, some don't, but that's not a uniform process. I think, I'm trying to think if there's any other dynamic risk factors in, because it's employment at the time of everything is at the time of the offense. So the other struggle with really both of these assessments, especially if someone's been on probation for a very long time, but they committed their offense at say 22, but we're still, that's where Dr. Gray, I think you were talking about, there's been studies like age or since release, but offense-free, there's a whole chart and graph as far as your risk should go down. But it's really, both of them are used at the time of release and don't really, well, that one doesn't get redone unless you said there's an offense. And that one, go ahead.
Ben Cook again. So anytime an offender comes to your organization, so if an offender moves into Pinal County, I'm required to do another assessment, either me or the city that they live in. At that time, we're going to reassess them. If they have a job at that time, it's poor at that time. But that's and then if they can present us with documentation for having completed sex offender counseling, if there was alcohol or drugs involved at the time of the incident, then they would also have to complete drug or alcohol treatment, and that can change if they've completed those. So I think there's the three questions that are changeable. Everything else is static.
I was just wondering if there's a gap between what Dr. Gray said about it moves into maintenance after a while, but if that doesn't change much, how does that, like, wouldn't it be good for a person to go into maintenance and possibly get released from the maintenance therapy, and then therefore that changes, and then it releases them from that?
Registration. And my assessment is just for community notification.
Correct, but I'm saying the things are kind of feeding into each other. There seems to be a gap in between that.
So, Peter Morey, answering your question, I'm putting on my attorney hat now. There are a couple other situations that the static 99 can go down. So one of the things built into the static 99 is that it does take in consideration age, because the physiologic makeup, particularly of men, and women, I mean, your libido goes down as you age. And so as you are getting out of those years into more elderly years, you're, 45, 60 years old and above. You're going to lower your risk factor, as well as other cases may come up that maybe something gets overturned or some other variable is found out can also affect some of the static 99 scores. So to your point, I agree with you that I think if somebody is moving into maintenance, it wouldn't be a bad idea to periodically do another static 99, because while it may not be a huge difference in the score, it could go down a point or two. And static 99 is really a baseline. The truism, the best way to predict the future is what did the person do in the past. And so you've got the static 99 that is a base. But, as Dr. Gray and Dr. Blades were saying, it's really a lot of the criminogenic and going forward variables that are going to be what we're going to be looking for. which I agree with Mr. Cook is kind of tough when you only have at one point in time that right. someone. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is so Katie Crutchy, to kind of follow up with what Mr. Cook says and what Beth had said about the community notification assessment. I think I talk to detectives in a lot of different cities, and different detectives interpret the 19 question community notification assessment differently. So some cities say, no, it's based on the time of offense. Were you employed? Were you using drugs? And there's no way to change that. It doesn't matter if they're sober. It doesn't matter if they've completed substance abuse treatment. It doesn't matter if they've been employed for the same employer for 10 years. Even though we know those are dynamic factors that actually decrease the person's risk, it won't change their community notification level. And it sounds like it's done differently in different cities. So I don't see it really changing. But yeah, most of how I see the community notification assessment questions are similar to static questions, but I think we heard from Dr. Blades and Dr. Gray that risk is not only the static risk factors, it's also the dynamic or the changeable factors. And so maybe part of what this board is doing and one of our tasks, right, is to address that community notification assessment. Maybe we look into including actual dynamic factors so that the community is actually notified about the people who are most risky. I think Dr. Blades told us, right, time offense free, decreases someone's risk. If we have people registering since 1978, why would that person necessarily be assessed as the highest level when that's probably not the person we need to be most worried about?
A little bit more on that. So would you say that, that's far looking, would you say that the dynamic factors are actually should be higher weight than the static factors, as she was saying, as dynamic factors change, especially in the positive, that the risks go down? So why would the community be more static information and only three or four questions of dynamic? Shouldn't it really be weighting on the other side?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me clarify maybe just a little bit. So in terms of kind of what we're talking about are two different pathways, I guess. So the community notification assessments don't have really anything to do with treatment, to be honest. As a treatment provider, I don't score those. I haven't really seen them. Except from sort of cursory glances. In treatment, we use the static, exactly as you said, to get a baseline, but I do want to make sure it's clear that the first item on the static is age at the time of release, you know, assuming the person served a sentence, or I guess at time of conviction from the index offense. So at the time that they went into the community after the index offense, so it actually respectfully does not change with their age. You, unless they commit a new offense and then the age changes, otherwise it cannot be rescored on them. So that's what I was saying. It really has the most utility in terms of predicting recidivism right at that time of reoffense. And then the longer that that person is in the community offense free, their risk, you know, goes down, and there's some research to that. I would say in terms of treatment, and I think on probation, we shift from the sort of baseline and relying on that static risk assessment into relying more heavily on the dynamic risk factors, because you're absolutely right. Otherwise it isn't fair, so to speak, or it's not as accurate because, you know, looking at someone's historical factors when it's maybe 20 years later isn't all that helpful, right? And so I would agree with that. And that is why we score the SOTIPs, or not score, but sort of speak to the SOTIPs factors for them regularly so that they get that dynamic information. But that is separate in terms of the sort of registration assessments. It does sound like perhaps there needs to be some revision there, but that's its own thing.
Jim Hanratty, I have a question about the stable 2007. I'm not familiar with that. Could you explain that a little bit, and maybe how that correlates to what we're talking about as a dynamic assessment?
So it's another dynamic risk assessment instrument. So you are familiar with the SOTIPs, right?
Yep.
It sounded like. So it's, you can think of it as very similar to the SOTIPs. There's research behind it that has sort of those empirically supported or validated factors that correlate to someone's risk for recidivism. And if on the criminogenic factors piece of your handout, or the criminogenic needs, it's going to be a lot of those same things. So it's going to have a deviant sexual interest, poor problem solving, impulsivity, how is someone cooperating with supervision, emotional congruence to children, all different kinds of factors on there. And that again, it needs to be scored at regular intervals so you can see if someone is, you know, improving, if they're having a hard time, and
That might be a good instrument then, Jim Hanrad again. That might be a good instrument for trying to assess, you know, like exit from that process, maybe to use that to help with the registration beef that even the public have about being on, you know, lifetime probation or lifetime registration, which is different. Like the gentleman said earlier, he went through it 7 years, went through treatment, went through probation, did everything he was supposed to do, and I'll take him on his word for that for now. And but he still has to register, can't get into an apartment, can't get a job. He's got this dark cloud hanging over his head that he has to, you know, deal with every day of his life. Can we really, as a board, talk about an exit from lifetime registration? And can we use dynamic risk assessment to do that?
I do not know.
I'm just looking at what the public asked. You know, I mean, the public came up and a gentleman said that. I mean, I know that lifetime registration was a beautiful thing when it first started because that was the only way we could put a tail on somebody who may be off probation in 5 or 10 years because of recidivism rates. We don't have any data after they're off probation, after they're off community supervision, when we were doing the containment model, which is different than the R&R, right?
It is. Yes, it's very different.
So that changed. So it seems to me that maybe we could, if we're going to assess people for treatment on how much intensity we're going to use for treatment, maybe we can think about the idea of how a person can petition the state to get off lifetime probation. They do that for probation and parole. Why can't they do it for registration as well?
We will. Though, Jim, refer back to our to-do list and what the statute says we can do, which is look at the community notification assessment at this time. I mean, not at this time, but on.
Sorry.
As a board.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Can I tie it all together?
Yes, please.
Okay, Shane Neils. So, building on what Dr. Blade was saying, so there's actually three different things going on. So there's what they're talking about is treatment. There's community notification, and there's also probation. There's three different things. So probation has their own assessments in the middle. So they utilize treatment information. Community notification level is not really factored into their supervision level, but probation assessments are kind of a combination of dynamic and static issues. So from a sex offender standpoint, the static 99 is kind of just a jumping off point when you have very little information at the beginning of treatment. And then as you get more information and there's dynamic things going on, probation should be adjusting to that and, you know, doing whatever they need to do to address those issues. Maybe they get temporarily pulled out of treatment to deal with a separate issue, maybe their own victimization or something. And as it's going on, in a perfect world, it's working collaboratively with treatment and polygraphers and law enforcement and kind of tying it all together in the containment model to best address whatever this person's issues are. So whether they're just out of DOC and they need basic needs like employment or housing or food box or whatever they need, you can't even get to all that stuff until you do the basic stuff. So in a perfect world, all this stuff is functioning together. But the community notification assessment, Madam Chair, and I used to teach the community notification assessment for 15 years. And so there's a ton of subjectivity with people that do the assessment. So when we would teach the class, if there was 20 people in the class, we would have people score a test subject, and we get 20 different scores almost every single time, 20 different scores. But the categories are broad enough that, for the most part, everybody falls in the same category. And the sticking point was usually, or it used to be until the new law, you know, people would want, if they were close to a level one from a level two, they would obviously want to be a level one so they're not on the website. Well, it's not really like that anymore, but that would be the suggestion is we would refer them to the notification detective and say, hey, let them know you completed treatment if you're close, and that might adjust your score down. So that's how that functions. But honestly, like bigger picture, I mean, Sex Offender Management Board, it's not the Sex Offender Registration Board. That's just one thing. I get it's an important thing, but it's just one thing. So, yeah, that tool is old, but it was based on research. I mean, you know, maybe outdated research, but it was based on research at the time. So being that a lot of those people are not on probation anymore or moved in from another state and they were never on supervision,
that notification detectives can only work with whatever they have in front of them. So that's usually the score from the previous jurisdiction and maybe their criminal history and self-report, whatever they say. But on probation, we have a lot more information. We have a whole file. We have all kinds of stuff. And treatment providers, they have all kinds of different stuff. So I don't know, people get kind of twisted between the treatment score, their treatment risk, where they're placing them in treatment, how much treatment they need, and then supervision. So that includes general criminogenic stuff, and if they have a long history of violent behavior, that's going to increase their general criminogenic issue, and then people that aren't even on supervision anymore. So that, I just feel like those are three totally different things, but it all kind of falls under the umbrella of sex offender management. So yeah, we would work with the treatment providers and the polygraphers and to best treat that person and even get the right polygraph questions, things like that to get the right information. But I think, needless to say, there's like a lot of work to do. But I just think back to her original presentation, this is just treatment stuff. This is not registration. This is not supervision. This is their treatment stuff. That's all.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Yes, sir. Yeah, and Peter Morey, question again. I need to shut up here. Are we going to have presentations from like probation and community supervision also? Because we don't know, a lot of us.
Yes. So Mr. Neal and I are happy to present on supervision. We developed many of the trainings over the years, policies and things like that. And I just talked to Mr. Cook earlier about him giving us a presentation on community notification, and not just the community notification assessment, but also issues that our community notification detectives across the state are having that perhaps we can hopefully pass on. So yes, and like I said earlier, if there's anybody that has requests for, anyone in this room or outside, if there's presentations, I think we should, and that's how we kind of collectively hopefully get on the same page or have an increasing understanding of what all of us have done or do. So yes. Ms. Krejci.
Katie Krejci, quick question. So I heard people talking about the containment model, and Dr. Blades talked about risk-based responsivity. Can someone clarify whether those are two different things, the same thing?
The containment model is separate from the R&R principle. The containment model is essentially treatment, probation, and the polygrapher working together to assess someone's risk and needs, for lack of a better word. So as Mr. Neal was explaining, in a perfect world, all three of these things are working together. And there's a number of assessments, which I will probably treatment assessments outside of these assessments, that treatment uses that then, as you know, probation gets. And then when the individual is due for a polygraph, which if someone was a high risk, probation high risk for their assessments, would get a maintenance polygraph, for example, every 6 months, whereas those assessed as a medium or low would typically should have polygraphs done annually, and no more than annually because it's tough for them. And the polygraphers have their own like rules, and we'll have you guys do presentations too. And so what would happen then is the treatment provider and probation officers should get together with the polygraph examiners, who will pick the questions, but we would send the topics in conjunction with treatment. So if someone was an individual on probation for sexual assault of an adult, and they were someone that had never had any offenses against children, why would you ask the question about children? It'd be more different behaviors. Or if someone was on probation for, viewing sexual abuse material, why would you ask about whatnot? I mean, I'm just pulling it, but it would be topics that you would make sure the polygraph was fruitful and beneficial for all, and the topics and questions that they formulate would then give you answers. And then with polygraphs, there's a number of different polygraphs. And so that's the containment model, as far as then if someone's dynamic risk is elevating. Someone gets someone breaks up with their longtime girlfriend. We know that can be weight. So probation maybe should be seeing them more because maybe they're depressed. Maybe something's going to happen where they maybe go into offense cycle for loss of a job, for example, death of a family member. All of those things that maybe an individual on probation would need more support from, you know, treatment or probation. And it's constantly monitoring that with individuals on probation. Does that make sense about?
Yeah, so is the containment model more of a supervision model and the risk needs responsivity is more of a treatment model?
I mean, maybe, but I think they're both. It's kind of addressed. I mean, I think the containment model has probably been around for quite a number of years, and R&R may be more like formal, whereas if the R&R speaks directly to the triangle and, you know, the treatment, polygraph, probation working together to address someone's needs and wherever they're at.
I think you could still probably use the R&R model is a little bit foundational in the sense that I think you could probably still use the principles of R&R as kind of the guiding basis for how you run the containment model. That makes sense. To me, the containment model always was explained a bit more as like how probation and treatment and polygraph and support people are supposed to function kind of as a team to help the person move forward on probation. But you could use the R&R model as the basis for how you do that. Does that make sense? They're kind of like two different phenomena.
Jim Hanratty, polygraph examiner. A containment approach was always addressed as a containment, literally the circle around for external boundaries, and the R&R was addressed as more of an integrated. So kind of a blend of the three to meet in the middle, more for the offender to get the justice-involved individual the help and supervision that they needed. But it wasn't contingent on a more hard approach of the external boundary. In other words, if there was a boundary breach, it was time to circle the wagons again and actually do something. There was a need to be retroactive to what happened at that breach, whether it was a treatment breach or a probation breach or child contact or something that wasn't actual a reoffense, but it was leading down that road. It was an attempt to intervene before something got way out of hand and a reoffense happened. That was where they came up with the containment approach. But I think it is more treatment oriented, to answer your question. I think it is because it's more integrated with treatment and probation and actually trying to make a difference, a positive difference in behavioral modification in the individual. It's more treatment oriented in that regard, in my opinion.
What the R&R is. I mean, what I would say is that you're sort of describing responsivity in the sense that as if someone has some sort of a breach or a problematic behavior that you feel the need to provide them with more support, you're then responsive to their needs. And we heard earlier the same thing of sort of if someone is assessed to be higher risk, they receive a polygraph maybe every 6 months versus annually. And so to me, that is sort of what we're describing in the risk needs responsivity model. You know, I think they do work in conjunction together.
Yeah, man, Randy, I think the R&R is more modernized, I think. I think it's more thought out. I think it has more research-based. I think it's definitely a better way to explain it. Containment sounds kind of like it's toxic. You know, it's like we're all wearing, like, hazmat suits or something. So I like the R&R technique.
Where's the polygraph?
Okay.
It's in there.
Is there anything? This started with your questions. If there's anything else you need from us, let me know.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Sorry, one more question.
Oh, go ahead.
Katie Ritchie. So I think Dr. Gray mentioned that sometimes if someone's low risk that they would not need supervision. Could someone also be low risk, like just from the start, from that point of release into the community, that they're low enough risk that they perhaps we don't even need to put resources into treatment? Is there anything that supports that, or do we think everyone needs to go through the treatment program?
Most of the research that we have now, especially the study that I had, everybody was in treatment, and the only reduction would be is that they were being in every 90 days in a maintenance kind of program, and so it went out for 15 years. There's some other studies that go out for 30 years, but I don't know how valid they are, frankly.
don't know if that helps.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you both very much for that. Okay, moving into a discussion of subcommittee chair and members. So in your packet, the subcommittee chairs were named. Scott Nagley will be chair of the juvenile subcommittee, and Dr. Blaze will be chair of the adult committee. Everyone has the names in front of them, with the addition of, Mr. Nagley will also be on the adult committee. That was a change that we made today. The chairs of the subcommittees will be meeting, I believe, at least monthly, and they will be working together to come up with those dates for, I would say, the next, the upcoming 2026 year, and topics. Dr. Blades, did you have anything else to talk about regarding subcommittees as chair of adult? Mr. Nagley could not be here today. And they will be open to anyone who wants to listen. I think that's when we're going to try to try the Teams approach, maybe by February, to see if we can do that virtually. Because I know those meetings will be helpful to have virtual. Did you have anything else you wanted to talk about regarding?
I think that's accurate. Virtual, probably more frequently initially, but shorter, to try to kind of wrap our head around what we need to do, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Any comments or questions on subcommittees as they hopefully get going next month? Okay, great. Okay, this will conclude our meeting unless there's any other discussion or thoughts or... Before I call for a motion, that's okay. Are there, I'm going to ask for any agenda items right now from anybody that they have for next month at this time.
Madam Chair, can I be heard briefly?
Please.
Just a friendly reminder about the subcommittees. Open meeting law also applies to subcommittees. So no meeting in private. Thank you.
Thank you for that. At this time, I want to thank everybody again for your work and dedication to this board. I'm really excited for 2026 and all that we will get done. I hope you all have a good holiday season, a happy new year. Our next meeting is January 8th, I believe. And now I will just January 12th. Thank you. And at this time, I will ask for a motion to adjourn.
I'll motion that we adjourn the meeting.
Do I have a second?
Katie Crutchy, I'll second that.
Thank you. Our meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everyone.